Yep, Tess is ready for questions. She said, pull up your chairs next to the fire if you want to. And
but that's what remains.
What remains? Of me? Of everything. Everything remains. The only thing that dies is the ego. I mean, just to use that language. I'm sure you know, do you know the Zen story? I'm sure a lot of you know this, about the guy who's going home from work one evening at dusk, at twilight, and he's going by a well and he sees a snake beside the well and he's terrified. He knows this is a poisonous snake or whatever, and he's absolutely terrified. And he's frozen with terror when he's there, and one of the neighbours comes up and says, what's the matter with you? The snake over there. That's not a snake, that's a rope. And immediately your man's fear and everything dissolves. That's basically what happens. We have what we thought was a snake is a rope. And once you realise that the snake is a rope, that's what's real. What's real is that it was a rope, then fear has gone. Just in the that's why they say realisation, you realise that the snake, that is a rope and not a snake. Just realise.
I'm wondering if you can talk at all about on your path smoking, if there were ever times you felt like you had to struggle against it, the habit, or if it was just kind of always there, if you engaged with it at all?
I've smoked off and on. I was off cigarettes for 22 years, and I fell back into bad habits, I suppose, about 10 or 15 years ago. And during that time, I sometimes smoke and I sometimes don't, for no reason. I mean, it just happens that the desire to smoke falls away. I had to smoke for 2 months. When all over Seamus's funeral and all of that, I smoked a lot for about 6 months. And then in summer, I just forgot to get cigarettes one day and didn't bother about them. And there were a couple of days when I kind of think, what am I going to do now? And I realised I was going to have a cigarette. Oh, no, won't bother. So there wasn't any big issue about it. And the day after I arrived back into the States, I just really, really wanted to get cigarettes. I went out and bought cigarettes, and I've been doing it since. I don't know what it's got to do with the spiritual path. I think some of it is accepting this desire or this whatever. I don't know. All I can say is Nisargadatta did it, and I would have liked, I must admit, there's a part of me that would have liked if the desire for smoking went away. It's the one regret I have about it. Wouldn't it be great if the smoking desire went away? But you know, I mean, basically what happens is just acceptance of everything, including smoking. I mean, we know plenty of people who seem to have been enlightened who drank themselves to death or whatever. They knew who they were, they knew what was going on, but they continued on drinking or whatever else it was. So I suppose addictions, I don't know really, that's all I can say about it. I know that, I mean, there is bad at home nowadays, you know. We know all the arguments against smoking and just even spending money, which I can ill afford and so on. But the rational mind is no longer running the scene. It's incomprehensible, I suppose. Hi, Bob.
When you were telling the story about the tunnel letting you in, the thought crossed my mind is, what was the next day like for you? What did you do the next day? It sounds like that happened at night, so I imagine you went to sleep.
Yeah.
And you woke up the next morning.
I've heard other people saying that their last thought, what was your last thought before this happened? And it struck me that my last thought was, oh, this is it. So in some way, because I don't remember after that. So I turned over and went to sleep. And I slept like as if I was an angel on a cloud for about 7 or 8 hours. And then I'm in the kitchen in the morning. I'm getting ready to go home fairly shortly. And this thing happened. I think I must not have been thinking or anything. I was just there. This is what I was doing. As if there was a cloud, a very diffused cloud of something. I cannot say material or whatever, but that sense. And I noticed it, and it just came together and it condensed, and it just came down through my head. Just, now, it wasn't like lightning or shocking, or it just came quite gently. And with it came the words, I am who am. Now, I don't know who said that, and I remember a wave of emotion at, you know, it was like that words had come back to articulate. And I hadn't noticed an absence of words, so I can only assume that the mind must not have been working for that period of time. I don't know, but that was just how it was for me. And then I could literally see the mind cranking up, trying to think about what had happened last night. And there was this sense of spaciousness. Do you know? And I also felt as if the whole world had woken up. The Buddha said that all of creation had awoken. And there was this sense of spaciousness. And then the mind was trying to think about it when I was packing the car and going. And I remember thinking, well, I wonder what happened. I look within. I'll check within myself, which is a very strong habit with me, and I nearly threw up. I just had this, you know, sense of nausea, and then I thought, you know, maybe I drank too much tea or something. You know, I didn't even think that, just that. And then maybe in an hour later or something, I did that again, and I tried that a few times, and then it dawned on me: there's no insight. I cannot go inside anymore. There is no insight. And as soon as I realised that, I also realised that there's only an insight in relation to an outside. This is what people were trying to say. There's only this. There's only one. So I got in my car and I drove home. And I had written a letter to Art, you know, just during the retreat. And I have no clue what was in that. And I had sealed it and all myself now about an hour before this happened. And then I thought, well, I'll still mail it to him. I had a stamp on it. The first post office I find or whatever I go by when I just mail it to him. I'll send him an email then, and I reckoned I had a whole week in which to send him an email, you know, because I couldn't articulate it and I couldn't find, didn't know what to say. And I got home and nobody noticed anything different about me. People said, oh, you enjoyed your holiday, obviously. You had a great you look great after you had a great rest. I was saying I had, so it was like that. So it was obvious to me there was something radically different, but I didn't know what to say about it. I mean, I couldn't say that day or in that week the identification has shifted. I couldn't use that kind of language. The mind was wiped. The mind was not able to think very much. So when I was trying to think of how I'd write to Art then, and I was thinking what I would say to him was, well, something has gone and it has left no memory, so I don't know what it is. Memory had wiped with it, and I don't know what it is. But I'm functioning fine, and so that was where I was at with trying to. And I knew Art would write back, well, please explain or can you describe more, and I just couldn't. But what happened anyway was towards the end of the week there was a sudden email from Art. He'd obviously gotten the letter, and I can't remember what it was. So then I wrote back to him and tried to explain a bit further. But all I could say was, it happened. But knowing Art, well, what happened? Can you explain to me or whatever? And I don't know at what stage I was ever able to articulate it or anything. But I wasn't able to come up with what, as I said, the mind wasn't functioning very much. And I found then things like, my daughter got married 6 weeks after this happened. So she was all in, you know, bridezilla mode and all of this kind of stuff. And I had, of course, to play mother of the bride. And I couldn't cope with the stimuli of the world. So I needed to go shopping. And it was just too much. It was, so I would just go in and put my head down and look, you know, where's that? Okay, I'll take that one. You know, shops or anything like that. It was just too much. I needed a lot of time to myself. Not because there was anything wrong or anything the matter. It was just the world was too much. And since then I've been saying I was presented in a protected situation, which was more or less had a pretty monastic life at home. Seamus was in the house and there was me, there was just the two of us, and so I didn't have to deal with anything much. It was easy enough to cater for us. But I remember the day after the wedding, you know, people are coming to me and talking to me and so on. And I think I think I got by without anybody noticing.
Did Seamus die before the wedding?
No, he didn't. Seamus only died 6 months ago. You didn't know that?
I knew he died.
Only 6 months ago. This was in the early days of... the awakening happened 18 months after he became ill. About 18 months. So I also feel that that situation created something. And in fact, you know, when we talk about ladder work, I used to always think, you know, I couldn't figure anything to do with ladder work, but I've extended my idea of ladder work to being service to the world, accepting what service is asked of you. That this was the service that was asked of me. And I certainly think it played a role in it. And I was surprised by a lot of things. I mean, you would think that logically, you know, if you've found what you're looking for, you know that you won't keep looking anymore. Well, I couldn't look. I couldn't even read the spine on the cover of a book. I just couldn't take anything in. So I found myself gradually putting books back, but I just hadn't thought of the implications of that, which meant I had a lot of free time. You know, I realised my mind had been completely preoccupied. I was always thinking about something or doing some practice or whatever. It was just all gone. So there was this freedom and lightness that went with it. But I'd say it was about a year before I could hardly open any book. I just hadn't thought about that. And I found when I started reading again, it wasn't spiritual books. It would be, you know, biography of somebody that seemed like an interesting person. And that I could read, and that was interesting to me. And I just cannot stand spiritual books now, to tell the truth. Yeah, I bought one recently. Gary Weber is, I'm speaking with him in Philly, and I thought, well, I should get his book so that I know what he's like. I got it, and I just couldn't read it. So it's remained like that for me. That was something I just hadn't anticipated. Does that relate to your experience?
Absolutely. I can read poetry. And I read art book. I still haven't read the entire book yet, the first one. But what I love about it is it's a page. You know, it's like, that's about all I can read. I can sit down and read a couple pages. So.
But I just think it's a... This is a little interesting thing for me. I had all the Bernadette Roberts books, and I had tried reading them, and I didn't get a lot. I'm sure I got something out of them, and been recommended because I'm from a Catholic background. But it was about 6 months after The Awakening, and one of her books was on the table, and I was putting it away, and I flicked it open. And I just flicked it on one page, and I read this paragraph. And in it, she described something that had happened to me exactly. I don't remember which of them it was, but what she described. Now I remembered it exactly the way it happened, but I never kept a journal, and I didn't realise the significance of things, and I didn't try to interpret a lot of things. I just accepted that was just how I was.
First was one of the few books that I've read after my realisation, and well, the book was The Experience of No Self, resonated with me. It's a comfort to read. It was an incredible book. Of course, when I got to the middle third of it, where she goes off on all these, just trying to correlate, you know, redefine Christianity and all this stuff, I didn't have any patience for that, and I skipped over that. But, you know, I haven't read her since. And I saw her give a lecture on a video one time with paper plates, and
funnily enough, I only got that about a month ago, and when I listened to it, it made complete sense to me.
The one with the paper plate?
Yeah. I'd never seen it before. I had heard of it and so on. But the incident that was in the book was looking within herself, she saw a voice, a thought stream, or whatever you call it, that was arguing for... You know, it was like the thought stream, like, well, I'm the ego, and I'm the survival mechanism, and you wouldn't have got this far in life without me. And then there was the opposite one saying, but look at all the trouble you got me into, you know, and I have to go someplace that you're not going, and, you know, you're not the boss kind of thing. And it literally felt like two teenage boys. and they were arguing with each other. But what she said, which was exactly what happened to me, so I was sitting in a chair and I was thinking about it, and then I'm up and I'm cooking the dinner and all this, and every time I stopped for a second, the two were still arguing. And I don't know, did it go on for a day or whatever, but it's a pretty strange thing to have a couple of 12-year-olds inside you arguing. Like, neither of them would give up. There was this persistence, but they were not producing any new arguments. They were just repeating themselves and maybe finding different words. And it just disappeared. It wasn't there the next day, or sometime I looked within, and that wasn't going on. But Bernadette put an interpretation on it, which I usually think in terms of, that's just another thing that happened, great. And her interpretation was that it was the voice of ego and the voice of, we'll say, of spiritual teachings, like the top of spiritual teachings, and it had come down to a showdown between them as to who was going to win. And she put it as one of them was wanting to close the gate of heaven and the other one was wanting to open the gate of heaven. And she said it must have ended up that the one opening the gate of heaven must have remained opened. That was her interpretation on it. But the description of it was so precisely. But that was the only thing that I had read. I thought it was like, whatever. Oh, David.
Yeah, I know a lot of us struggle at some level. I've struggled with it. We need to want to do this for ourselves.
Say that again. Say it again.
We need to want to find ourselves for ourselves.
That's right.
Not for anyone or anything else.
That's right.
And I guess we need to get to a point where we don't care if we're destroying the planet or not. But does this have any effect on other people? On other people, when this happens to somebody, is there a positive effect of any kind? Or, I mean, traditionally, only a very small number of people that are attracted to do this kind of thing, in the mysticism and so forth. But is there any positive effect it has on the planet or your surroundings in some way?
Richard Rose said something. Maybe somebody here might be able to help me better with this. It was something. Trying to fix the world or tamper with the world before you know who you are and what your relationship to it is foolish. After you know what the world is or your relationship to it, that's when you can really do something, you know, if that's what you're called to do. So it's like meddling around with something when you don't know, when you don't have a proper understanding of what it is.
You can break it.
Yeah, but you know, I mean, how many times? I mean, remember this thing of scientists had the one of the reasons that the agendas of science was to grow more food so that there would never be any more hunger in the world. And guess what happened when we found ways to grow more food? The population grew. So, like, I'm just saying that as good intentions coming from a human level may not play out the way we imagined.
He was very circumspect about giving advice to people. That he said, you know, he would say sometimes, "Well, I don't know what you should do." He had a way he could obviously give guidance and advice to people, but he did it in for the most part. And I'm sure he gave some people some very specific point about a specific thing they had asked him about. But in general, his attitude was, you know, you've got to make a commitment, follow through on it, if your desire for it's finding the truth to lead you. And he didn't know what was right or wrong for you to do in terms of your destiny or your life. Mm-hmm. And to tell somebody, well, you should do such and so, you know, it's paying debt. Could have been counterproductive for you.
Yeah.
He was humble about, you know, this idea that his perspective made him all-knowing in some way. Tell people how many hairs you have on your head.
Yeah. He had such a, what would you say, whimsical way of saying things, didn't he? His own original language. Well, I'm going to go back, David, and I'm going to say something to you. Your relationship with yourself is primary. That's the most important thing. Your relationship with anybody or anything else is secondary. And the only one that you can really have any effect on or change or do whatever is your relationship with yourself. And the big problem, just put it in this language for us, our troubles and so on, come from the fact that we think that we're something that we're not. You sometimes use the language, you're identified with it. But it's not just one identification. It's this identification keeps hopping all over the place. But there is something permanent and fundamental about us. What's real within us. And I loved what Richard Rohr said there about we come to know what reality is through finding what is real within ourselves. And until that time, our relationship with the world or our ideas about the world may not be accurate. That makes sense to you?
Yeah.
Right. This minute?
What's happening for you? No, not this minute, in your life. How are things unfolding?
I don't know.
I think maybe just to focus out the question a little bit more. So, quite a bit of talk about both the deepening of it with time. So I don't want to put words in your mouth. How do you feel?
A deepening. Well, how can there be, for me, a deepening of a realization? You know, you realize something or you recognize something, and now it's, you have the big picture, shall we say, or you are the big picture. Now, life continues after that, but what comes up and the way in which you interpret it is different because of that. It's coming from a different background, is all I can say. So, of course, my life has changed. My husband died recently, so for the first time probably in my life, I'm a free person, we'll say, with no responsibilities to anybody. So that's a new thing for me. I don't know where that'll take me or where it's going, where this empty space will go, but it's a, I don't see a deepening in myself. What I do see is, it seems I've become better at articulating something, but the perspective hasn't changed. What goes on within it, I find myself maybe looking with a different eye at it. I don't know if that makes any sense to you. I've become able to read again. I've become able to engage with the world. And oddly enough, just since around Seamus's funeral, my sort of introvertedness and need for a lot of time alone and silence, it just seems to have dissipated. And actually, I find myself having become really social. I'm just telling people at the retreat that I even found myself one day in summer deciding I'd go down the town to see could I find someone to have a drink with. That's probably the first time in my life that I was sitting at home and I thought, I thought, you know, I mean, I would make an appointment to meet people or go and meet them, but here I am thinking, well, yeah, maybe I go down the town and see if I'm going looking for company. And that, you know, so I don't know where that'll take me. I mean, it might take me to going down the town every night and drink. I don't know, but so, I mean, I don't know if that's what you mean by things changing. I mean, that does seem a surprise to me, and a delightful surprise.
I wanted to keep it open just to see.
I don't know if you'd call that deepening or expanding. But yeah, sure. I mean, and I suppose my responses to what happened, I suppose they're a bit different when you have a different, when your perception of what's going on. Realization to me, everything else pales in comparison to it. It is the, I can look around any place, and I know people telling me about their suffering or whatever, that the one way out of this is to become who you are. So of course I see everything with those eyes. That's the underlying kind of idea behind. And, you know, a lot of times, I mean, people at home don't know anything about this aspect of me or anything, so I don't say anything. So if people come and ask me, I just respond to what comes up in front of me, actually. It's whatever it is. And, I mean, for 4.5 years now, it seems to have been fine, including Seamus's dying. It was just, this is the way it's playing out. I don't know if that's what they mean by integration, you know, integrating the world back into my life, you know, going down the town for drinks. Is that, you know, because I wasn't able to deal with the world for a couple of years. It was, it just needed to get back home here. And that seems to have become much easier for me and more natural. Just natural, it's just natural how it is now.
Your reactions change?
My reactions. Reactions are unconscious. Actions are not.
So you don't have any reactions?
I think not. Doesn't seem to me. It might look the same. It looks the same on the outside. You know, but yeah, there's a consciousness that's constantly there. So, you know, I don't think I could fall into it. I mean, it couldn't fall out of it, so to speak. And somebody asked me at the retreat the other day, I had read a poem and it had something about Seamus in it, and I started crying at the end of it. And they were asking me, where did the tears come from? What was that? And all I could say is it comes from the same place as the laughter. You know, there's no need to explain it, there's no need to do anything with it. So it's not like people are unemotional or, I mean, if anything, one's heart feeling for everybody and everything is much more open, I think. So no reactions. But you can't do anything until they disappear by themselves for another reason. You can't be suppressing reactions, you have to use them as fodder. Use everything as fodder to see, why did I react? What was that about? Just, you know, it changes suffering when you realize that you can use it as, you can do something with it in relation to your higher goal.
Would you say are your responses, it's more just responding now, and all your responses are appropriate?
I don't know whether they are or not. I mean, other people would have to tell me whether they're appropriate or not. It just happens. I mean, I suppose you could analyze it after the fact or look at it or whatever. But I don't know. I suppose that's for other people to...
But for you, does it feel that way? That your responses are appropriate without having to think about it?
Yeah, I don't... It just happens,
yeah.
And that's what it is, and then it's gone. It's very nice that people are so kind to me and nice to me. It's just lovely. I mean, I've had people argue with me and fight with me as well. I mean, a couple of times it's happened that people said, you're not enlightened, you know, because enlightened people don't smoke and this kind of thing. And actually, the first time that happened, it was very interesting to me that I had no reaction to it. That was perfectly fine. I could just see this other person doing their stuff and there was no reaction to me. And actually what did happen was my mind was trying to figure out what would be a skillful response to this person. And that was all that happened, and there was no emotional anything to it. And that was a surprise to me. Like, it was like, oh, so that's what happens. David.
In the traditions I've studied, in one way or another, they express it. So it's like the universe becomes your body. You know, I guess
so that last sentence?
The universe becomes your body. The as much as you have a physical body and there's a physical universe and there's no longer a separation or difference between those two. I don't know. So if your arm breaks a foot and a half from your head and a tree falls 300 feet away, do you feel both?
No. I don't feel anybody else's pain either. If I get crack my big toe, I feel it, but I don't feel it when other people crack their big toe. So the body hasn't got confused at all about it. It seems to me that what you're saying there is an attempt to put some kind of an understanding on something that you can't understand. The mind is struggling to, you know, what this statement means. It must mean this. And trying to put, as I said, some explanation or interpretation on it. And it just doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense to you either. Because in your own experience, you know, you don't, but, and certainly I'm not certainly feeling other people banging their big toes. But I, you know, it's, you can spend an awful lot of time trying to understand something, using the mind to understand it and to interpret what teacher said or whatever. But basically what I'm saying is, don't worry about that. Start working on yourself. Use the kind of tools I was talking about. And if you don't understand what they're saying, just don't try to understand it, but try to do what you need to do to find the real part within yourself. And with that, then you'll know for yourself. You won't be depending on what anybody else says. Know thyself. Know for yourself. Nathan.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, we've only 5 minutes. I thought I was going to let you out of class early, but it seems... Laura.
I was wondering if you could speak about your process before the awakening group and how you were working with yourself, and if there was some kind of acceleration of
looking back over my life, and I would say that until the last piece falls into place, I certainly didn't see the big picture. But when that last piece falls into place, I could look back over my whole life and see. And I would never have at any stage told you that my spiritual search started when I was 9. I never forgot that particular incident. And so I was always doing things, and the best idea I had was I wanted to be a person of integrity. This was the idea I had. And I knew that you didn't become a person of integrity automatically. You had to work at it and do things. So I was always reading stuff and doing what I could and trying to be an ethical person and be honest and all of that kind of stuff. So I was still trying to fix the person. I wanted to test to be a person of integrity. That was still the idea that I had. And when I came across Tat, my idea of what I was at changed. And also the possibility of something. And I thought this was to go on until your deathbed. You just used your whole life for this, and you know, maybe when you died you went to heaven. Not that I could buy into that, but still, there was something. So the first time I came to Tat, I would say about it, the first thing that happened was I was given a diagnosis. You're a seeker. You're not the only one in the world. There's thousands of others all over the place. This is a condition. Then I was given some descriptions of my disease in terms of, you know, you're misidentified. What's causing this seeking is that there's something wrong, and we refer to it as a misidentification. You're not who you think you are. You're something else. So now I had kind of the cause of the whole thing. And then I was given a prescription of, here's some things you can do. Self-inquiry and whatever, with solitary retreats and so on. So I just was doing all of those things. And I was just doing them. I just I knew that I had tried every other avenue to fix myself in the world to get whatever, and it was like this one door had opened where there was a possibility that there was something more to this. And I, with hindsight, I began to understand books that I had read that I couldn't understand. I said, that's actually what they were trying to say too, only I didn't get it about the misidentification. Actually, once that happened, things began to happen to me in terms of Kundalini, and intuition began to come through in a way that I recognized as something coming from within rather than without. And, you know, little satoris of various kinds, and it did speed up. And particularly the last week when I was on solitary retreat, there was just so much, well, you could call them mystical experiences or whatever, but I was sort of inured to them. So I had gotten inured over time to just accepting them, which is why when there was a light in the corner over there, I didn't bother my head with it, because I was used to lights and used to whatever. So I wasn't expecting it to be something major. I packed up to go home. So I was, you know, basically getting into bed. So maybe finally, whatever we might call the ego or something, had just settled down, and so this one could happen. I don't know. That was just the way it happened. I knew that there was what I called a spiritual pregnancy going on. I knew that for 3 years. The universe was, there was a spiritual pregnancy going on in the universe. It was about me, but it had nothing to do with me. I had no hand, plant, or act in it. And I know that sounds utterly ridiculous, but, you know, a woman who has had babies might well think it was an analogy or a metaphor like that. But I just accepted it. I had no idea at the time, actually, when I became aware of this intuition or universal mother was around, when this information came to me. And I did ask, well, you know, how long is a spiritual pregnancy? Well, we know a human one is 9 months, a dog's one is whatever. Cut. She disappeared, or whatever it was, disappeared, didn't give me any more information. So I thought, well, this might go on for my whole lifetime or for my deathbed. But there was something in me that was relieved that it was happening. I knew now it had started happening. It was like I had realized I am pregnant. Now, the unit, the world or whatever, you know, just as a woman, the world knows, or whatever, the world knows what to do with a pregnancy. I really don't have to do anything else except facilitate it. And that was the kind of mindset I had. And that was about 3 years before the end that had happened. But I didn't have any idea. Was it 3 weeks, 3 months, I just didn't have any idea. It's only with hindsight that I can look back and I remember exactly when that happened. So I'm always surprised at people who say they were walking down the street and they suddenly realised who they were. I think, oh my God, you got off light. Not that this was painful or anything for me. And then they continued on with their lives. As I was just saying to Bob there, I mean, there was a year or a couple of years when, you know, I had to treat myself delicately in the world until I mean, literally like somebody who's just been newborn. I wasn't able to, the stimuli of the world were too much until I don't know, got used to it or whatever. Well, I think we're going to go and have a break, or is it lunch or whatever. But any of you that want to talk to me, please come and get me, whatever you want to say. I mean, I'll try and have time with everybody, but take your time with me if that's what you need, or if you have something. All right? Okay, school's out.